From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
When it comes to politics, there's a helpful saying, ignore the words, follow the money. Like other states, every year the California governor and legislature negotiate a new budget. The end result reflects their true values and priorities. For Californians who pay taxes, however, the state budget process is a mystery. Our guest, Scott Graves from the California Budget and Policy Center, will tell you how the state budget is put together and how your tax dollars are spent. Following the Money, a primer on the California budget process.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, as well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Wheeland, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. We've all heard the saying that actions are more important than words. That's particularly true in government. If you really want to know a politician's real priorities, you need look no farther than the budget they're proposing. But budgets can be difficult for the average voter to understand. We're fortunate to have an expert, Scott Graves, who's the Director of Research for the California Budget and Policy Center, here to help explain the California budget process. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you. I will do my best.
Okay. Well, first, can you explain where the money comes from to pay for the California state budget?
Well, ultimately, the money comes from California's taxpayers, either through the state personal income tax, state sales taxes, when we all go to the store and buy something that's taxed, we're contributing to the state budget, and also those of us who are paying federal taxes, a lot of that money is coming back to California. So that money all flows back into the state budget and is accounted for in a couple ways. We have federal funds in our state budget that makes up about one-third of the budget. Mm-hmm. That's just over $100 billion in the coming year. And then state funds make up about two-thirds of the state budget. That's around $180 billion. The largest state fund is called our general fund, not a very exciting name for a fund, but that's sort of the fund out of which our legislators and governor can apportion dollars for any purpose allowed by law. There are no strings attached to those general fund dollars, and that's the biggest portion of state spending.
It's interesting, you know, you're saying about $300 billion total-ish, $287. And people throw around $1 million like it's budget dust in Sacramento.
Yeah.
It's not that big a deal, right?
Yeah.
When you look at a billion-dollar budget, it isn't that big a deal.
Right. Until you get up to a billion or more, that's when you're talking real money.
Okay. It's always an interesting concept. So you stated that the state budget is a local budget. How so?
I think a lot of people think that because the budget is crafted in Sacramento, that all of the dollars remain in Sacramento. But the reality is the state budget sends money out across California every year, and very few of those dollars actually remain in Sacramento. So that's why when we're talking about the state budget, it's important to think of it as not being just some state-level thing, but it's actually providing a lot of services that are flowing out at the local level.
You know, but sometimes when you think about that, it's kind of passed through that the state really has with the budget and with revenue. It's almost like he who has the gold makes the rule. So sometimes the state can put strings attached to the local governments, I suppose. You know, there's a lot of public services supported by the state budget. Can you talk about a few of those?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest one that a lot of people are surprised by is K-12 public education. I think a lot of Californians think that most money for their public schools comes from their local property taxes, and property taxes do play a big role in public education, but most of the money that public schools are spending every year is coming from our state budget. So that's one big piece of it. Higher education also gets a lot of money from the state budget. The community colleges, the California State University, there are 23 campuses around the state, the 10 University of California campuses. We have a Medi-Cal health coverage program.
That's very big.
Very big. That's a $100 billion program in California, federal and state money. We've got a lot of services that help families in need, including at-risk children through the foster care and child welfare services programs. And, of course, we have a lot of public safety expenditures at the state level.
Right.
We have 34 state prisons scattered around California. We spend more than $10 billion general fund dollars per year on our correction system. So that's another big piece of spending.
It's interesting you say corrections. A lot of people assume, if you ask them, you know, what does the state spend the money on? A lot of people, I think, will say corrections and crime, but that's actually, it's big, but it's kind of the,
It's not one of the biggest expenditures.
Right. The biggest expenditure in the state budget, just speaking about the general fund, is K-12 education. If you look at correction spending at the state level, it's been dropping in recent years because of the state's efforts to reduce incarceration. Still around 8 to 9% of our general fund budget is going into our prison and parole system. But that's smaller than what we spend on higher education as a share of the budget, and much smaller than what we spend on K-12.
Yeah, I think the number that's on K-12 is about 40% on K-12 and community college, and then another 10% or so for higher education. So if you just compare prisons, you know, incarceration, about 8 or 9% compared to, let's say, K-12, which is like 40%, and we're talking, you know, five times as much for education. I think people would be surprised by that.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. The state budget is actually a bill. You described it, though, as, quote, a bill of a different kind. What did you mean by that?
So a lot of people are familiar with the policy process in the legislature, where you have a bill and it gets introduced in one house and it moves through various committees, goes to the floor, then it goes to the next house. The budget bill is not like that. It is a bill, and here's an example of a recent budget bill.
It's light reading.
It's over 700 pages long with thousands and thousands of numbers in it. But it's different from your standard bill for, you know, a couple of reasons. One is that it is moving through budget committees in the legislature, not through policy committees.
Okay.
It's generally moving with other bills as part of a package. It's never alone. It's never flying solo. It's always got 20, 30, or 40 bills attached to it that help to
implement. Barnacles on a ship.
Yeah, right. There they are. You can't have a budget bill without the what are called trailer bills or budget-related bills. And also the bill is different not only because it's so long, but because it covers everything that state government does. It funds an array of programs and services for a single fiscal year.
Wow. So thanks for that overview of the state budget. Yeah. Up next, we're going to talk about the what, who, and when of the state budget. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, and I'm talking with Scott Graves, the Director of Research for the Nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. So the California budget seems to have a language all its own. It's like a foreign language. And there are some key terms, though, that most people should know. So let's go through a few key terms.
Sure.
One is the governor's proposed budget. What's that?
So the proposed budget is the spending plan that the governor unveils or releases every January after a several months long process within his administration to figure out what he wants his budget to look like. So these are very big documents. This is not for the faint of heart. Here's an older version from the Gray Davis administration. It's as big as a big city telephone book, hundreds of pages long, with a lot of very almost unintelligible jargon in many places and filled with numbers. So this is where you go if you want to know, you're interested in a particular department or agency spending, you want to know how much they spent last year, how much they're estimated to spend in the current year, and how much the governor is proposing to spend in the next fiscal year.
Put the green eye shades on.
Yes.
Okay, so then we've got the governor's budget summary. What's that?
Okay, here's another somewhat older version of that. The summary
seems a little smaller.
It's smaller. This is the narrative that accompanies the big budget. So this is more text and fewer numbers. This is where you go if you want to have a better understanding of the governor's revenue outlook. Does he think revenues are going to be up or down for the next fiscal
year? Explains the numbers.
Right. His economic outlook, does he have any major policy initiatives that he wants the legislature to pass? So that's where you would go to find all of those things, plus the governor's rationale for his budget. This is the governor's view of the world.
Okay. Then we've got the May revise, or the May revision. Revise is probably not grammatically correct, but that's what people call it. What is that?
So the May revision is the governor's second bite at the apple. Essentially, he unveils his budget proposal in January, a few months go by, legislators look at it, and then after we know what personal income taxes look like in California in April, the governor then released tax day, we all pay our taxes in April, or, you know, I hope we do. then the governor takes a look at that and says, okay, revenues are better than I thought they'd be. Revenues are worse than I thought they'd be. A lot of things have changed in the last few months. He revises his budget proposal and releases it by May 14th, and then legislators take a look at that.
Okay, then you've got budget bills and you've got trailer bills. Can you talk about those for a second?
So the budget bill, this is the several hundred pages long document that gets introduced every year. And there can be more than one budget bill. A lot of people think there's only one budget bill. Often there's more than one because they make changes to it throughout the year. But the budget bill essentially contains thousands of appropriations that tell agencies, boards, commissions, universities that they can spend a certain amount of money from a certain fund For a certain amount of time, for a specific purpose.
And I'm guessing, like, if you're in the UC, you're going to be focusing specifically on the section on the University of California.
You want to be able to
see. Not going to read the whole thing.
Right, what the governor is proposing in your area, exactly. Right. So the trailer bills, these are the bills that accompany the budget bill, because the budget bill doesn't tell you much beyond the numbers, how much can be spent. The trailer bills or budget-related bills, such as this one, for example, they can be bigger or smaller than this, they sort of explain how state law is going to have to change in order to implement the policies and spending assumed in the budget.
Are those
bill.
The barnacles on the ship we were talking
barnacles
about?
Barnacles on the ship. You might have, in years past, maybe 20 years ago, there would have been 10 of these accompanying the budget bill. During the Great Recession, when we had the big deficits in California a few years ago, there were 40 or 50 of these trailer bills. In the recent years, it's been more in the range of maybe 25 or 30. So there's a lot. There are a lot of bills that move along with the budget bill through the process.
Then we've got some key players in the process. So quickly, you know, Department of Finance.
Department of Finance is the governor's chief fiscal policy advisor. They prepare all of the governor's budget-related documents. This is going on in any given year from July through June, basically the whole year.
Okay,
they're always at work.
Then you got the assembly committees and the Senate committees.
Yes. So the budget committees and the legislature review the governor's proposals and they craft their own version of the budget before they go into final negotiations with the governor.
Okay, and then we got the Legislative Analyst Office.
The LAO, they are the advisors to the legislature. They essentially work for state lawmakers and not for the governor. They look at the governor's budget, they advise the legislature on it, and they put out publications.
Let's talk about the timeline for the state budget. It's ongoing. This thing is, you know,
right.
12 months a year, but let's start at January.
Okay.
Kind of walk us through the timeline for the state budget from January.
Okay, you made a key point there. Before you get to January, there's a lot that goes on. So it's really important for Californians to understand that it is a cyclical process. There's always someone in Sacramento thinking about the state budget. If it were a sport, there would be no off-season. So there's always some aspect of the budget process going on. January, the big event is the governor releases his proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. That must be a balanced budget, meaning he has to show that revenues equal or exceed the spending that he is proposing. That has to be done by January 10th.
Okay. So he's projecting that, and then it goes to the legislative committee hearings sometime in the spring.
Right. March, April, early May, the legislature, both the Assembly and the Senate, will hold dozens of hearings digging into the details of the governor's proposals.
Okay. And then we've got May 14th is the governor's May revise.
Right. May 14th, that's the date when the governor puts out his updated budget proposal, taking into account how the world has changed in the previous 4 months.
And then there's legislative committees, you know, working in the Senate and the Assembly and during June. Then we got June 15th is the next big deadline.
June 15th, that's another constitutional deadline. The legislature is required to pass the budget bill, no other bills, just the budget bill by midnight on June 15th. If they miss that deadline, they lose their pay and their reimbursement for travel and living expenses for every day they're late.
That'll get their attention.
It's an incentive, and they have, since that rule went into effect 7 years ago, they've never missed the deadline.
Not too many, I'm guessing, not too many late budgets. And then we got July 1.
Start of the fiscal year. So we have a 12-month fiscal year. It runs July 1st through June 30th.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking about the who, what, when, where, and why about the state budget process. Up next, we're going to talk about the state constitution and how it sets some kind of key rules of the road when it comes to the California state budget process. What are they? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. We're talking with Scott Graves, the director of research for the nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. You know, the California Constitution sets some important rules regarding the budget process. What are they? So one thing the California Constitution does is it talks about tax increases, and it requires a supermajority or a two-thirds vote. What are some of the taxes that require this two-thirds vote? What are we talking about?
Yes. Back in 2010, the voters passed an initiative that requires that any taxpayer who will be asked to pay a higher tax, that requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature.
Well, and he's a loaded term.
So, I mean, you could imagine a situation where legislators want to cut taxes for 35 million people and raise taxes on five people. That bill would require a two-thirds vote because five people would be paying a higher tax.
Wow.
They really tightened up the rules through Proposition 26 back in 2010.
Now, you're hearing that a lot now with cap and trade. I mean, cap and trade, when they first proposed it, they said, oh, this isn't a tax. This is to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. But there's currently litigation asking whether or not the cap and trade charge is a tax. And if it does, it needs a two-thirds support of the legislature. So the governor now is working on that to try to get the legislature to reauthorize that.
Right. So that goes to the question of what is a tax and what is a fee.
Right.
The other thing that Prop 26 did is it expanded the definition of a tax. So many increases that used to be considered fees and the legislature could pass by a majority vote, they now require a two-thirds supermajority vote. So
yeah.
That's
so it's
raising
kind of,
that issue.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a tax. Just because you call it a fee.
Well, they've got very clearly defined rules now. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the past, the budget bill needed a two-thirds majority to pass. In 2010, you talked about this Prop 25, which allowed budget bills and trailer bills to pass on a simple majority vote. But what if you got a tax package, a bill, a trailer bill or something that's part of the budget package? Does that need a two-thirds vote?
Yes. So any bill that's included in the budget package that otherwise requires a two-thirds vote still needs a two-thirds vote.
So you can't get around it?
No. So if you want to raise taxes, you need a two-thirds vote, even if you're doing it to balance the budget. If you want to put a constitutional amendment before the voters, you still need a two-thirds vote because the Constitution says so. You can't say, well, it's part of the budget, so it should pass by majority vote. No,
okay.
You need the supermajority.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
Okay, so then in 2016, the voters approved Prop 54. And that said that bills have to be published at least 72 hours before the legislature takes any action. Mm-hmm. So since the state budget is a bill, how does the 72-hour rule impact the budget process?
That 72-hour rule applies to every bill, including the budget bill and budget-related bills known as trailer bills. So what this essentially means is the deadline for the legislature to pass the budget bill without being penalized is June 15th, midnight. That means if they have to have the budget bill in print for 3 days or 72 hours, they really have to have the budget done by June 12th. So one thing that has happened is there's already a compressed timeline between when the governor releases his May revision in mid-May and when they have to get the budget done. Now Prop 54 has made that timeline a little bit shorter by backing up the date by which the legislature has to have a bill.
So it's really compressed time. I mean, I assume the legislature then is working some long hours.
Yeah, there's a lot of negotiations that go on between mid-May and early June. That's when the rubber really hits the road, and it's also when the process moves very quickly, and it gets harder for the public, Joe Q public, to see the process, what's going on, and to influence the process.
So we've got a lot of legislatures and probably news reporters just putting in some pretty long nights during that compressed period between the May revise and when the budget has to be done.
That's right. And now the real deadline is going to be June 12th, not June 15th.
No wonder I can't get anybody on the phone during that time. I think you just gave me the answer. I just want to go over one last thing because we talked about it earlier, and that was the penalties if a budget is late under Prop 25. What were the penalties again?
So if the legislature has not passed and sent to the governor the budget bill, just sent to the governor, he can veto it, he can do anything he wants with it. If they miss the June 15th deadline, every day that they're late, they forfeit their pay and the additional money that they get to pay
that
for travel,
per diem,
the travel and living expenses. So they would forfeit that money. Since that rule went into effect in 2010, they have never missed the deadline. So there have been various reasons why we've had on-time budgets since Governor Brown came back into the governor's office. But, you know, probably a small role is played by the fact that if the legislature actually misses its deadline, they'll have to pay a financial penalty.
Yeah, and it gets their attention for sure. Well, thank you for providing that overview of some of the important rules of the budget process. Up next, you know, the people of California do have a direct say in the state budget process through the initiative and proposition process. It's called ballot box budgeting. What impact does it have on the state budget? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Scott Graves, the Director of Research for the Nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. As we've discussed, the governor and the legislature craft the state's annual spending plan according to rules outlined by the state constitution. California voters, however, have periodically reviewed and revised the state constitution, and that's had a profound effect on how the state budget process occurs. A great example of that is Prop 98, which was passed in 1998 and sets a guaranteed level of funding for K-12 schools and community colleges. So I'm guessing I know it's pretty complicated from what I've read, but how is the minimum guarantee for education calculated, and can it be changed or modified?
So it is a very complicated formula that is used every year to figure out how much of the general fund will go toward K-12 schools and community colleges, which are also in the formula. There are three tests that apply under different economic and fiscal circumstances. So, you know, we're
it's
not going
really complicated.
Not gonna get, it's really complicated. The number of people who actually understand it could fit around this table right now.
I think one of the people who designed it actually said he sent his kids to Stanford based on his knowledge and what he was able to, you know, sell that for basically to other people,
right.
Because it's just so complicated.
It is complicated, but it is a key piece of the budget process every year, because until legislators and the governor have a good handle on how much the state is going to owe for Prop 98 to K-14 education, they don't really have a sense of how much of the state budget is left for other programs and services.
There's another one, Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund, which was approved by voters in 2014.
Right.
What impact on the state budget does that have?
So that has put in a fairly rigid formula that does require the state to set aside what amounts to billions of dollars every year into a rainy day fund to save for the next recession when things start to go downhill again,
right.
And also to pay off some of our budgetary debt, which includes unfunded pension liabilities.
Right.
So that is a new thing that the voters put in effect, a new priority that they wanted to see.
Yeah, it's interesting. And they're talking about, you know, about $10 billion in all the reserves to state government. But when you look back at the recession, the Great Recession, the state was running $20 billion deficit. So $10 billion sounds like a lot as a reserve, but you know, based on recent history, maybe not enough. Okay, so 2016, Prop 55 was passed. It's kind of a continuation of a tax on wealthy Californians. What impact on the budget process?
So that will leave in place for another 12 years through 2030. The personal income tax rate increases on the highest income Californians. It does allow the sales tax rate increase that was part of the original initiative that put these tax increases in place back in 2012, that sales tax increase has expired. What Prop 55 does that's different, though, is that it requires during certain years and under certain circumstances some general fund dollars to go automatically to the Medi-Cal program, which provides health care to low and moderate income Californians. So it puts a new rule in there.
I want to ask you quickly about the this thing called a state mandate. What are they and how do they impact the state budget process?
So state mandates are essentially requirements from the state that local governments perform certain activities. Decades ago, and maybe not so long ago, the state would tell locals that it needed to do certain things and it wouldn't pay for them. The locals didn't like that, and they got voters to pass a couple of initiatives that tightened up the rules. So now, essentially, the state legislature, if it wants local governments to do something, it has to pay for it.
Okay.
If they're not going to pay for it, they have to suspend the mandate.
Okay, so we'll end with this last question. Overall, what is the impact of these voter initiatives and propositions on the state budget process? What would your impression be?
Well, it's essentially a way that the voters are setting priorities for their elected officials in Sacramento. So the voters have said, as we've just talked about, that they want to be certain that a good share of the state budget goes to our public schools and community colleges every year. They've said they want to see a lot of money set aside in a rainy day reserve. So it doesn't completely tie the hands of our legislators and our governor, but it does impose some requirements on them that they have to follow every year when they build the budget.
Follow the money. If you really want to know what the priorities are for the state citizens or the governor or the legislature, follow the money. It's all in the budget. Well, I want to thank our guest, the Director of Research at the California Budget and Policy Center, Scott Graves. If you also want to stay up with state and local politics, you can sign up for our daily e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by going onto our website at maddieinstitute.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in The Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or The Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org. Up next, if there's anyone who could say they've been there, done that when it comes to the state budget, it's our next guest, outgoing California legislative analyst Mac Taylor.
You're listening to The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
After 40 years with the California Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office
and the last 10 years as its chief, Mac Taylor is retiring, just the fifth person to serve in that position in the office's 77-year history. We'll ask him how state politics and public policy debates, particularly over the state budget, have changed over his time in state government, and why integrity and civility still matter when it comes to crafting good public policy.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Perhaps no one is more well-known and influential in the State Capitol and unknown to most Californians as our guest, Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst. He's stepping down after 40 years with the Legislative Analyst's Office, the last 10 years as its leader. I've asked him to kind of get his unique perspective on California's political process generally and the state budget in particular. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
So how would you describe the work of the Legislative Analyst's Office?
Well, the office was set up in 1941, and the legislature at that
first
time...
First one in the country, right.
First one in the country, and I think the legislature was tired of being dependent on the executive branch. And so it wanted its own information source. So I think the two really important things about the office is that we are legislative staff serving the legislature as an institution, and we have a mission to examine the operations of state and local governments and try to come up with ideas to make them work either better or more efficiently. So my folks, and we go out and we look at programs and we talk to people and we try to provide information for the legislature so they can do their oversight role.
Yeah, kind of the fraud, waste, and abuse that people always focus on with state government. Not so much the fraud aspect, but, you know, the waste, maybe. How can you do things more efficiently, more effectively as a state government?
Yeah, I don't think you have to go to the fraud and waste for most stuff. Certainly
state auditor can handle the...
Well, no, but it's just even in our own lives and the things that we deal with, you can do things better.
Right. You know, it's interesting. People hear the term legislative in your title, and I think they think your office is somehow partisan, that you might do the bidding of whatever legislative party's in power. That's not it at all, is it?
Well, we don't think so. The second legislative analyst, a gentleman by the name of A. Allen Post, which only old-timers will now remember, he really set up the reputation of the office as operating in a nonpartisan manner. Mm-hmm. And it's really one of the most crucial things that the way we operate. It describes the way we operate. And, you know, I've been, as you said, been here in the office for 40 years, almost equal time with Republican governors and Democratic governors. And we've done our job exactly the same way, no matter sort of who's in that position.
You know, it's interesting. The LAO is oftentimes compared to the Federal Congressional Budget Office, or the CBO. But the LAO actually, your office operates a little differently than the CBO. How so?
Well, like we said, we were established in 41. The CBO was created in the mid-70s. And I think they looked around and certainly looked at our office as one model that they might want to emulate. And it's a great office. They have some incredibly talented, capable people. But there's one thing that they don't do. They don't make recommendations. Mm-hmm. So that if they did a report on some topic, they might offer options. But they wouldn't recommend that, Congress, you do this.
Right.
And I think they felt, the drafters of the law that created CBO, I think just felt it would make it too visible, too controversial.
I think it makes it more difficult. If you're making recommendations, you're sticking your head out there a little bit, and someone is not going to be happy.
But we've always done that. We don't do it in every case, mm-hmm. but we try to push to recommendations, again, to help the legislature in helping them think about what direction they might want to go.
Because they can always push back for whatever. If they have reasons and justifications,
Absolutely.
It sharpens the decision-making process.
I think that's the point. We're trying to help them make as good as decisions as possible.
You know, the LAO is probably best known for its work on the budget. And I said this to you the first time we met. I'm going to say it again the last time we meet here. A longtime Capitol reporter had a unique way of describing the work of your office, and I think this is a great quote. He said, quote, "Think of the LAO as the conscience of the Capitol. Collectively, they are the skunk that ruins the budget garden party that the governor and legislature would otherwise enjoy every year," unquote. So would you describe your role in the state budget process?
Yeah.
And by the way, the skunk is a compliment.
Yeah, I don't know why you like the skunk metaphor here, Mark. Our role, we're primarily known for our budget role as sort of a mm-hmm. fiscal office. It's not all we do with policy issues, too, but we always have had a strong budget role. So when the governor's budget comes out each January, one of our biggest jobs is helping the legislature understand what is in the budget, describing what's in the budget, assessing it, offering alternatives, perhaps, to what the governor has proposed. We also have a strong role in doing fiscal forecasts. We do expenditure, revenue, economic forecast. And we're the only office that is, in effect, a counterpart to the administration's estimating group. And I think, again, that helps the legislature have their own independent voice on those key matters.
Because sometimes if you go forward, we have had governors who have kind of, I don't want to say lowballed it, but then been very conservative in their revenue estimates because they don't want to spend as much money. You can come in and say, well, wait a second, the revenues are a little bit better, or vice versa.
It happened the other way. I remember in a prior administration where they had a factor that they'd added for economic growth or something, and we're going to have $1 billion more. And I think, again, the legislature has somebody can turn to just assess those claims and sometimes offer them an alternative to them, but hopefully just help them have a richer and better understanding of what their fiscal situation is.
Okay, well, more of our conversation with Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, in a moment. This is the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. We're talking with Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, who's retiring after working at the state capitol since Jerry Brown was first elected governor back in 1978.
Some things don't change.
Puts things in perspective. You're both leaving at the same time. So can you tell us a little bit about your background? You know, what drew you to public service generally and the LAO in particular?
Well, I was a political science major in college, and like a lot of young people, you know, you're interested in the issues of the day, the current events and things. And I was fortunate to have a professor there who showed me some internships and got me involved that way and turned me on to public policy programs, which are master's programs that are sort of have quantitative and economic emphasis in their programs. And I think as I went through school, I got much more interested in policy than maybe
and
in
you're
politics.
And you're very humble. You went to Princeton. It's a school that a lot of us, you know, wow, that's a very impressive. And then you graduate from Princeton. In 1978, you take a job with the LAO. The timing.
Timing was not great. I'd accepted in the spring of that year, and then Proposition 13 passed, which were all sorts of accounts. Oh, this is going to decimate, you know, state and local services.
Turn the car around.
Yeah, I'm coming across country thinking, man, I don't even have a job.
Oh, man, that's pretty interesting.
But the LAO was clearly an obvious choice if you were coming back to California. If you wanted to do especially nonpartisan policy work, that's one place you would certainly apply.
Yes, you were more focused, it seems, on policy than politics.
Yes, absolutely, and more so as I went through school.
Yeah. So who appoints a legislative analyst? How does that selection process work? Is it always a unanimous election? How does that work?
Well, we actually have a joint committee, the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, that oversees the office and makes the appointment for the legislative analyst. And they've only had to do that four times in the 77 years. And there's no process laid out necessarily. Necessarily, it has to follow certain steps or anything. I think the past couple of times you've had a subcommittee that's made up of both Democrats and Republicans to try to winnow through the candidates and come up with a selection. But it's not always unanimous, no.
But I would think, though, that, you know, that's an incredibly important position. And if you want to kind of have public policy discussions turn in a certain direction, there'd be a lot of pressure to get your person in as a legislative analyst. How do you keep that process kind of pure?
You know, I think the members have realized that the office is a little bit different in the way it was set up and what it does. And, you know, you'd like to think they'll do that again, because I think they realize what is required to maintain that sort of nonpartisanship.
So what are some of the essential qualities that you think are important in a legislative analyst?
Well, I think you could list, a lot of things for anybody heading up any sort of office. I think a couple of essential ones, though. It has to be a person who has that nonpartisan background, that has either done work like that, can relate to it, and would be accepted to all parties, not just the two parties in the legislature, but the perception throughout state government, this is a person that we can deal with. But I think you do have to have an analytically rigorous person. I think it helps to have some strong quantitative skills, to have a background in public finance, because those are the kind of issues that I've had to deal with, my predecessors have had to deal with. And so having that kind of background, I think, can be extraordinarily helpful.
You were talking about your predecessor, your most recent predecessor, the person right before you was Elizabeth Hill. She was the first woman to head up the California Legislative Analyst Office. She did that for 22 years. That's hard to believe. That was a long time. What'd you learn from her?
Oh, well, I was fortunate to be a deputy under Liz for like 17 years. So I did get to work with her very closely. And hopefully I picked up, just either through osmosis, a lot of things, because Liz had a lot of remarkable qualities. She was incredibly hardworking, very methodical. She had a great way with people, whether they were inside the office or outside the office, and just a person of really high integrity. Just watching her work was a great sort of way to mentor.
I remember asking her a question once, and she was, boom, the answer, a lot like you, boom, the answer right away, and also was expecting a follow-up. And she was. I said, boy, you better be on your toes when you're around this person.
Incredibly well-prepared, always.
Yeah. Anyone else role model for you?
Well, you know, I think you learn from just, I've had the pleasure of working with incredibly talented people over those 40 years, both inside the office and outside in state government. But I think the first analyst that I worked for, Bill Hamm, who was Liz's predecessor, and took over from AL and Post. And Bill was another person of great integrity, but also did incredibly sharp. He was one of the most analytically rigorous people I've run into, and was able to quickly get to the nub of an issue, right, which I think, given all the things that you have to deal with, it was a quality that I really admired, his ability to, whether it was editing a document, and quickly get to what is it that we need to say. So I certainly would include him in the people I consider as mentors.
You know, I was practicing law before I did this job, and I used to work with someone who was just that same way. I mean, he could hit the issue, get rid of all the noise, get right to the point. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
Get rid of all the background stuff. Well, the California Legislative Analyst is often asked to provide an unbiased assessment on most of the critical public policy issues facing the state. So what is it like to be asked to block out all the political noise and dispassionately analyze the state's most critical public policy issues? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with the retiring California Legislative Analyst, Mac Taylor, who politicians of all stripes look to for an unbiased assessment regarding some of the most significant public policy issues facing the state of California. So I imagine that one of your greatest challenges came during the Great Recession, with its multi-billion dollar budget shortfalls and the state's general budget crisis. And I recall you saying when we first met during that time that the state was looking at $20 billion shortfalls or deficits as far as the eye could see. And to put it in perspective, the budget at the time was about $100 billion. So that was a pretty big chunk of money. You've had to make some pretty tough calls over the time. You've referred to some ideas put out by certain governors as quote-unquote ill-conceived. And your analysis seems to have its effect more often than not. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you know, you mentioned the Great Recession. I took over the office really right at the time when we were learning how bad things were.
Yeah, we were talking before we started the taping today, and we were saying, you know, you started with Proposition 13 at the LAO, and then you became the LAO at the Great Recession. I'm wondering what's going to happen now.
What do you say? I'm an omen? I'm a bad omen. It was a really tough time, and the news just got worse and worse. $20 billion, that would have been great if that was the worst of our problems. And so you sort of felt bad. You were always going to the legislative leadership telling them, I'm sorry, you know, your problem is now even worse after you've taken all these action to correct your problem. But I hope the office was able to help in the sense of, again, providing our fiscal forecast, I think, was very helpful because they had numbers that were not just from the administration that they could assess their situation. We talked a lot about out years and structural mm-hmm. problems to see if your problem was going to get worse. Was it getting better? To give them a little bit longer perspective.
Right, took them out of that short-term focus and, you know, further out.
And we talked a lot about the whole revenue volatility. Why were we in this situation? And we were, I think, one of the first to sort of talk about that.
Some could argue that it may have gotten worse over time.
It has gotten a little bit worse over time. It has. Yeah. But even just helping people understand what revenue volatility meant.
Right.
And then what does that mean? Well, it means you have a couple of ways to deal with it, one of which was building reserves, right, which we stressed, and we have made tremendous progress in that area.
Yeah. You know, a Sacramento Bee reporter once told me that one topic that generates the most responses from his readers were stories on California's unfunded liabilities generally, but specifically about the state's unfunded public employee retiree liabilities. You know, the governor's talked about this thing called a structural deficit. Is that what he's talking about?
No, it's a little bit different. The okay. structural deficit typically is just comparing how much money you got coming in with your spending commitments.
Okay.
And typically, if you're spending more and it goes on for many years, you got a structural problem,
okay,
not just a one-time problem. Okay. The unfunded liabilities can be related to that issue.
Okay.
But the unfunded liabilities are really someone's problem from the past that is carried over to you. It means we didn't fund them when we should have. And now we have these responsibilities that you still have to take care of.
There are some big ticket items there. You're talking about public employee pensions, you know, including teacher pensions. You're talking about public employee retirement health care. We're talking billions and billions of dollars.
There are billions and billions. There are hundreds of billions of dollars. But I think what people need to look at maybe a little more closely, you do need to look at the size of the numbers, but you really then need to ask, is the legislature budgeting in their annual budget? Are they providing mm-hmm. for funds that will take care of that problem over time? Sorry, sort of amortizing those liabilities in the same way that you pay off a mortgage over 30 years. So we've done a lot better job, the legislature and the governor in recent years, to recognizing those liabilities and providing funding streams that will help reduce the nature of those problems.
And I'm feeling we're going to be talking about this for a while.
Oh, yes. It's not going to go away.
Whole other
but
program.
But we have made some really good progress in recent years.
Yeah. Well, let me kind of switch gears a little bit, talk about another one of the duties of the LAO, and that's to provide a financial analysis of the propositions on the California ballot. I imagine that explaining the real cost of some of these measures, particularly when they're popular, probably going to annoy some people and please others. Any particular situations come to mind? And how'd you handle it?
Well, I'm not sure I want to talk about particular situations.
No names.
But, you know, it is become a, it's the one thing we do that's not a legislative function. We don't do it for the legislature. We do it, in effect, for the people as a whole, and there was responsibility given to us. And it's a really important one that we take very seriously. And we know these measures are controversial. You think about the things that have been improved in recent years, some of the more controversial things have been on the ballot. Yeah. What we do, though, I think, to try to deal with it is we always meet with proponents and opponents. And we want to hear what they have to say. They typically provide us with lots of good information. We challenge them. We press them on their claims. But they know that we want to hear from them.
Yeah, I got to tell you, when I was reading that about the LAO, I was kind of surprised. I thought maybe you'd kind of keep yourself above the fray and kind of do a dispassionate analysis and not talk to anybody. But actually, I can see the point of getting in there and hearing what is your best argument for, what's your best argument against.
Oh, we like to talk to lots of people, not just proponents and opponents. There may be other people who are more disinterested.
Stakeholders.
Whatever information people want to give us. And then we try to have to sift through it because oftentimes we're told exactly opposite, contrary things by the proponents' opponents. So we're going to have to find our way through it. But we certainly have found that that process, I think, helps give people confidence that we are at least listening to them.
Yeah, and that means a lot. And I want to ask one last question in the segment. That is about a related issue, ballot box budgeting, the practice of making these major budget decisions by propositions. What makes these things particularly challenging is that unlike the normal budget process, these things are commonly written into the California Constitution and can't be changed unless you have another ballot measure. I mean, what are your thoughts on ballot box budgeting?
It's even worse than that. Even if they're not constitutional, they're statutory, they can only be changed by a subsequent vote of the people. So it really restricts the legislature. And my concern, and what I find really to be a very bad trend, is that when we've passed tax increases on cigarettes, on cannabis, on millionaires, they've had designated ways they wanted to spend that money as opposed to just putting it into our general fund.
Right.
And that means those priorities that the proponents of those measures set up in that year, those are your priorities now, from now in perpetuity.
Forever, right.
And that's just contrary, in my view, to good budgeting.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the importance of integrity and civility in the political process. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kupler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with retiring California legislative analyst Mac Taylor about the need, people might say now more than ever, for a credible, fact-based source of information and analysis regarding public policy issues facing the state. You know, despite the fact that the LAO has had to take some positions, recommendations that might upset the governor or the legislature from time to time, there's been very little turnover in your position. You're just the fifth legislative analyst over the last 77 years. Are you at all concerned that this hands-off approach may change in this age of hyper-partisanship?
Well, I mean, I think you're always concerned just because the office is a little bit different and you are, as you said, you're in a partisan environment. So, I mean, that's always an issue that's out there. But I have to tell you, the legislature has really been great about letting us do our job. I mean, in 10 years, no member has ever called me over and in any way tried to influence the way that we did our job. So it doesn't mean that they accept what we say all the time.
But they do if you agree with them.
Well, if they agree with us, they like to use our as supporting evidence. But that's not the way it's supposed to work. We're supposed to present our information and they can do with it whatever they want because we're the staff. But I think that they have been great about letting us do our job and not interfering with that analytical process.
That's pretty amazing. You know, Senator Patrick Moynihan once famously remarked that you have the right to your own opinion, but you don't have a right to your own facts. Today it seems that's one of the problems, that people can't agree on just what are the facts. What do you think needs to be done to help foster a better understanding of what are the facts?
Well, maybe, you know, process is really important, which is why I think you have a budget process, you have hearings on bills, and it shouldn't just be sort of pro forma things. That hearing is to help you determine what are the most appropriate facts. How reliable are we? Can we have confidence in them? And I think a lot of times we just have to understand that, you know, people come at things differently. You and I might agree to two or three facts, but you might weight the importance of those facts differently. So I think if we spent more time understanding why is it that we differ, why is it that we weight different facts differently, or our understanding of those facts differ, I think we could probably get a long ways further down the road of at least understanding what our differences are, and we can approach those things in a perhaps more civil way.
Yeah, one of the things that they used to say about Senator Mattie was that he said about his opponents, never assume the worst in your opponent, assume the best intentions of your opponent. You're both aiming at point B, the same maybe goal, just have a different perspective on how to get there.
You may be. You may not be. But whatever, you want to try to understand what that person is trying to do, right, and what is it the way they're going about it. I always tell, when I look for arguments that are being made by my own staff, sometimes I want them to, okay, now make the other case. Because that will show, do you really understand the other person's position, and right, what is the strongest sort of opposing points that help you then hopefully get closer to the truth?
Yeah, we actually encourage our students to do legislative internships. If you're a Democrat, go work in a Republican office. If you're a Republican, go work in a Democratic office. One of two things are going to happen. Either one, you're going to modify your positions based on new information, or it's going to strengthen your position because you've heard the best arguments and you think yours are better.
I think that's really good.
So let me ask you this last question. I think it's extremely important this day and age. You know, you've been lauded for your integrity and civility. Why do you think those are so essential in crafting good public policy?
Well, that's a tough one. I think there's a lot of gray area in most public policy issues. Mm-hmm. I think when you come at it from a very partisan way, your ideology might sort of determine where you're going to be on the issue. But in fact, issues are complex. There's oftentimes not good data. And so I think it helps if you have a certain amount of humility about what you know, what you think you know. And if you have that, you're at least going to be more willing and more open to maybe someone changing your mind or slightly modifying your view to make it a stronger, better one. So I think civility is just a way of appreciating that there is much that you have that you can learn about something. And then, again, you're going to treat this other person who might think differently from you with respect.
What about integrity?
Well, I think integrity is particularly important for the office. I think we have to have almost higher standards because in a partisan world, we need to be respected by both sides, with all players in the capital scene. They don't have to agree with us. They may not appreciate the way we did an analysis, but I would hope that they would feel like the analyst goes about things and they try to do things in an analytically sound way, that they're fair, that they're open to hearing from a lot of people.
Wise advice from retiring California legislative analyst Mac Taylor. I want to thank you for being on the program, but also for 40 years of public service.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. If you want to learn more about state and local politics, you can follow the Mattie Institute on Twitter, Facebook, or log on to our website at mattieinstitute.com. This is Mark Kepler for the Mattie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Mattie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Mattie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Mattie Report, visit our website at mattieinstitute.org.
The Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Mattie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.